When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Slash Film Daily for July 7th, 2017. This is Peter Soretta. Today on the podcast, we'll be talking about a few things in the water cooler. We'll be talking about a new podcast and a board game. In the news, we'll be talking about the most iconic shot in the Spider-Man Homecoming trailer and why it isn't in the movie. Matt Reeves has been talking a lot about his upcoming Batman movie, so we'll delve into that. Kevin Feige explains a cool Easter egg in Spider-Man Homecoming. And in the mailbag, we will attempt to answer what really counts as a spoiler. And after that, we will have a spoiler section where Jack Drew will join us to talk about the hidden movie references of Baby Driver. And we'll give you complete spoiler warning in there. But right now on the line, I have Ben Pearson from SlashFilm.com. Ben, how are you?
Hey, how's it going, Peter?
Good. What have you been up to lately, Ben?
So in the most recent edition of The Water Cooler, the feature that we run on the site every week, I talked about a new podcast, or a relatively new podcast, called The Secret History of Hollywood. And I've been burning through these episodes, some of which, Peter, I kid you not, are 8 hours and 58 minutes long for a single episode.
People complain when we go over 30 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. This is serious stuff. Talk about deep dives. This podcast is incredible. I would highly, highly recommend it to anybody who loves movies and podcasts, which I assume is a lot of people listening right now. So this is much more of a story. Like the guy who created the podcast, his name is Adam Roach. I believe that's how you pronounce it. And it's basically just a one-man show, one-man operation. He writes, researches, does the whole thing himself, produces the show, and he's the only voice on it, except for actually in this, a couple of the most recent episodes, Mark Gatiss, who is, you might recognize as one of the characters on Sherlock. He was in a couple episodes of Game of Thrones. He is like a celebrity who has latched on and realized that, the potential of this podcast, and he's actually lent his voice to a couple of the more recent episodes. But for the most part, it's a one-man show, and he speaks in a much more of a storytelling type of way, whereas Karina Longworth, I think, has more of an overview of the history. It's more fact-based, The Secret History of Hollywood is more of like, you're listening, you're sitting around a campfire almost, like listening to someone spin a tale. And like, it's all true, but it's the way that the information is conveyed is very different. And as evidenced by an 8 hour long, 9 hour long podcast episode, they really, take the time to dive into every little, crevice of the various subjects that they cover. So one of the series covers the dual rise of the Warner Brothers with actor James Cagney, which was really fantastic. I think that one's like 3 or 4 parts long. And then the one that they're doing right now, which is just wrapped up its second episode, is about a producer named Val Lewton, who I don't really know much about, but worked on Gone with the Wind and a bunch of stuff with David O. Selznick back in the day. So it is one of the best podcasts that I've heard that has do with movies, and I would highly, highly recommend it.
Wow. Now I want to listen to this podcast, but I'm afraid to put it on my podcast app of choice, which is Overcast. What I've been up to lately is over the holiday, I had a few friends over, including Jeff Cannata from the Slash Film cast, and we played some board games. But I wanted to mention one board game in particular called Escape from 100 Million BC, and it's from IDW Games, and it's from designer Kevin Wilson, who did Descent, Arkham Horror, Game of Thrones, the board game. So a bunch of great games. But the reason why you listeners might be interested in this, it's a time travel board game, and all the players are working together. You have tried to attempt to time travel, and you've somehow landed in 100 million BC, and your time machine has exploded all over the prehistoric era, and you need to recover not only the pieces of the time machine, but also equipment that has scattered, among the dinosaurs and among, this world, this prehistoric world. And basically, you don't want any piece of evidence that you were there to have, caused any paradoxes.
That's awesome.
Because if you leave, a Snickers wrapper or a gun that, fell out of the time machine, whatever, that could potentially cause big problems. And you landing there has also opened time holes that basically, when you start like causing these paradoxes, these castaways from other times end up getting sucked into that time. So you could have historical figures like Abraham Lincoln, and if you can't return him back to the future, history is forever changed. So
it's awesome.
Yeah, it's this adventure where you're all working together, and you not only have to get all the pieces of the time machine, but you also have to, you're going to have encounters with dinosaurs, but you don't want to kill the dinosaur, because if you kill the dinosaur, it's like, it's the butterfly effect.
Yeah, yeah.
It's basically Sound of Thunder, the game, if you've ever read that book, or God help you, watch that movie. The movie's horrible. The book is good. It's that. Anyways, let's get into the news. People aren't here to listen to us talk about podcasts or board games. First up, director Matt Reeves is going around promoting War for the Planet of the Apes, but everybody's asking him about The Batman, his next film starring Ben Affleck as of right now. He discussed having ideas for a possible trilogy, but also that he wants the first film to be a more emotional Batman movie. And I think you've wrote up part of this at slashfilm.com. What do we know, Ben?
Yeah, so basically he's compared the world of Batman and the world that Caesar inhabits in his Planet of the Apes movies, and said that these are both sort of damaged characters who are grappling to do the right thing in an imperfect world, which I think is an apt comparison between those characters. And he also he praised Christopher Nolan's approach to the movie. And I'd recently read a book about Batman by Glenn Weldon, and it was about the rise of nerd culture and the history of Batman. And so one of the things the book talks about is how there's no real wrong approach to The Dark Knight, but the modern era interpretation of Batman has very much slanted toward the Nolan verse. And I think fans are going to be happy to hear that, or fans of Nolan's movies anyway, which is most people, are going to be happy to hear that Matt Reeves seems to be taking a page out of Nolan's playbook, where he wants to tell a story that has deep emotional resonance and is thematically interesting, while also being, the sort of noir driven detective story, Batman mystery kind of movie on the surface, but also sort of digs in and covers adult themes underneath the cover of that fantasy.
He is saying that they're planning a trilogy. He says that this first film is the vital first story that they're concentrating on. I know there's a lot of hate out there in the current film climate of studios and filmmakers planning the cinematic universes, but to me, when I hear a director or a filmmaker of Matt Reeves' level say that they're planning for a trilogy arc, that makes me happy, because as much as I, want a complete story in a film, I love, the Planet of the Apes trilogy that we have right now, in my mind, is the best trilogy since Indiana Jones. And it is that way because it kind of tells this really complete story. And it's in the age that we are now with TV and serialized storytelling, I don't think it's always a sin when we're planning for the future.
Yeah, it helps. Yeah, it helps that Reeves is a great filmmaker and has proven, with these Apes movies that he can pull off envisioning a big world and executing it in a satisfying way, both on the action end and on the thematic end. So I think what a lot of people, the pushback comes when people are like, okay, let's grab these, properties out of that are, you know, free IP, basically, you know, King Arthur and whatever, and just like set up a half-assed cinematic world that way and promise you, you know, oh, nine more movies are coming after this, but without really putting enough thought into the first movie to make anybody give a crap about the rest of them. So I think Reeves is one of those guys where you're right, the caliber of filmmaker that he is, and he, you know, he has the history behind him to the resume, the proof is right there in the work that he's already done, that yeah, he can execute this stuff if he goes into a project with a vision for multiple movies in a row.
So next in the news is one of the most iconic shots in the Spider-Man Homecoming trailers isn't actually in the movie. And this isn't a spoiler to tell you that something isn't in the movie, but there's a shot in all the Spider-Man Homecoming marketing campaign where it shows Spider-Man and Iron Man flying through the New York City side by side. And this moment never happens in the film. You wrote this article for SlashFilm.com. How did this moment come about?
Yeah, so John Watts, the director, spoke with Matt Singer over at Screen Crush, and Matt asked about these moments. There's that moment, and there's one shot also where the Vulture sort of crashes down through a hotel atrium, and Watts was talking about basically how that atrium shot was created for like a Comic-Con sizzle reel a couple years ago or a year ago or whatever, before they had really shot a considerable amount of footage. Had only been filming for a couple weeks, and that was never really meant to be in the movie. And then the iconic shot of Spider-Man and Iron Man swinging through the city was actually supposed to be, that was, you know, from the marketing department. They said they wanted a shot of those two together, and then they were going to use something from the movie during the Staten Island Ferry sequence, which has also been featured heavily in the trailers, but Watts just didn't think it looked very good. So he, I think, shot a separate plate of just the city, and then, you know, had his team sort of composite those characters into that, just to create that shot specifically for the marketing. So this is not, you know, any sort of diabolical thing. It happens all the time. You actually mentioned, you know, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, being a big example, big recent example of another movie doing sort of similar tactics.
And that had a twofold, because it had some footage that was from deleted scenes that didn't end up being used in the film, but it also had like these outtakes that Gareth Edwards captured in between takes, like the most iconic of Jin in front of those lights in that Imperial, you know, lighting up. That was like basis for most of the marketing campaign. But the one thing in particular is the shot of Jin walking towards the TIE fighter on top of the Citadel Tower, something that was never in the movie. And if you listen to interviews and stuff with the filmmakers and stuff, they kind of tiptoe around it, and they're like, oh, that was something we were playing around with. But the truth of the matter, and I've confirmed this with multiple sources, is that Disney marketing needed a kind of visceral shot to put in the trailers, and they basically took that footage and invented it, had ILM invent it. If you look at the footage, Jin doesn't even look up at the TIE fighter that's coming in front of her. It's because there was never supposed to be a TIE fighter there.
Yeah, so that seems way more egregious than this shot, because even though that the shot from Spider-Man Homecoming is not in the movie, there's plenty of Iron Man in the movie, and it doesn't really change the story in any significant way. There was I remember in the trailer for The Transporter, the Jason Statham movie from the early 2000s, that there's the scene where he deflects a missile that's shot into his kitchen by using a dinner platter, and he deflects the missile into an oven and it explodes. And that's what I saw in the trailer, and I was like, holy crap, I have to see this movie. And then that scene is not even in the film at all. So that's what I felt, that's where I felt like taken advantage of. And I tried to talk, I was like, I don't know, very young at the time, and I talked to the manager of the theater, and I was like trying to talk to them about getting my money back because of false advertising, and they're like, it doesn't work that way, I'm not giving you your money back. But but yeah, that was a big moment for me, where I was like, oh, not everything from the trailers is always going to be in the movie.
Moving on from that, another Spider-Man Homecoming news tidbit, and we have this on the site. I want to warn you, this is not a spoiler. I would not consider this a spoiler. This is casting. Jennifer Connelly is part of Spider-Man Homecoming, part of the cast of Spider-Man Homecoming. She has a voice role in the movie, and she was a late addition to the cast. I talked to producers Kevin Feige and Amy Pascal last week about her addition to the film, and you can hear that right now.
Peter, well done. We've been doing this for 2 days.
We are the one person doing that.
Nobody's answered yet.
Well, that's a little minute for you.
We they had this conceit, and it actually grew in post that he would interact with a suit. And we like the idea of it being a female voice that Tony's programmed into it. And it actually came about pretty quickly. We were talking about who could do it, and she popped up for three reasons. One, she's a great actress, can do anything she wants. Two, she inhabited some of those classic 80s films that helped to inspire us behind the scenes. And three, and most meta, she's married to Jarvis.
Right. So it's pretty great.
So basically, it's just kind of a fun bit of casting because Jennifer Connelly is the real life wife of the guy that plays Jarvis. And I don't think she's going to end up playing Jarvis's wife in the movie because they already have an actress that played Jarvis's wife in Agent Carter, the TV show. And it looks nothing like Jennifer Connelly. But, and it's also a fun reference because there's so many references to 80s movies, some of which Jennifer Connelly was a part of.
Yeah, that's really cool. I also didn't think about that connection, but Connelly does a really good job as the suit lady in this movie.
Suit lady. It was funny when the first press screening of this happened. After the first press screening, they released the press notes, and it had the full cast list, which had some spoilers, so watch out on the internet. But one of the lists on listings on the cast list was Jennifer Connelly, and almost everybody at the press screening was like, on Twitter, like, she's not in the movie. There's no one named Suit Lady in the movie. So it's not even a thing that if you saw the movie, you'd be like, oh, look, there's Jennifer Connelly. It's, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But speaking of which, I put this article on slashfilm.com, and we got quite a few replies on Twitter complaining of spoilers. And this is the topic of today's In the Mailbag. Brian Banks asks, what really counts as a spoiler? Can a movie news site possibly cater to non-trailer watchers? So, I first want to say that, and first appearances, if you didn't know Jennifer Connelly was in this movie and you see a headline that says Jennifer Connelly, you know, Kevin Feige talks about Jennifer Connelly in Spider-Man Homecoming, you might, alarms go off and you're like, oh no, they're ruining a big surprise. Mm-hmm. They're bringing her character from the Hulk into the Marvel Cinematic Universe or, you know, something.
Right.
But that's not the case at all, obviously, as you've just heard. And when you see the film, you know, it's not a spoiler. But let's get to what is a spoiler? What would you consider a spoiler, Ben?
Oh, man, that's a tough question. I would say something that, you know, maybe is revealed late in the movie. You know, something that the story hinges on, or something that's unexpected in the context of the story that you're being told. You know, if somebody, you know, if for example, the real Jennifer Connelly played, I don't know, some major Spider-Man character and popped up, you know, 5 minutes before the movie came out, then I would say, yeah, that would probably be a spoiler. But in the context that this is presented, I would say that's definitely not a spoiler. It's hard because I'm spoiler averse, generally speaking, myself.
And you're also one of those people that, like, when, you know, you aren't writing up a trailer on slashfilm.com, you're not watching it.
Yes, that's true. So it's tough because I love the theatrical experience, and I love being able to you know, have the movie told to me in the context and that it was meant to be told. And I have always had this thing where maybe that transporter story I told earlier had something to do with that, actually, now that I think about it. But I think I've always had this thing where I've been waiting for the big moments that I've seen in the trailer when I'm sitting there in the theater watching a movie. And sometimes if they happen or don't happen, I'm just sort of like checking them off of a mental list. And I would much rather sweep all of that away and just get swept away in the story that the movie is trying to tell. So that's my sort of take on it, is if I'm not writing something up about a movie, I will definitely avoid a trailer for something that I'm interested in seeing. If I still need to be convinced or something, for sure, I'll definitely watch it. But for, you know, a new Nolan movie or whatever it is, I'm generally not going to watch the trailer unless I have to write about it.
See, I'm a little bit of the opposite because I like the hype and I like the hype train. And like, you know, love getting excited about movies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'll watch every trailer for the next Star Wars movie and, you know, get excited about it and overanalyze it. And maybe that ruins the movie for me. I don't think it did. But I always say that my experience with, you know, Phantom Menace, of having years of excitement, you know, geeking out, waiting in line for tickets, waiting in line for the movie, you know, all of that, even though the movie wasn't great, I wouldn't trade it for anything else in the world because it was a fun ride as a fan. And I know that's not everybody would agree with that, but I definitely, of movies that I'm super excited about that I don't want to geek out in that level, I'll still see the teaser trailer because I like seeing what it's going to, you know, get a taste.
Yeah, I'll do the same thing. I'll watch teasers all day, but it's when that you start getting into 1, 2, 3, 4 full-length trailers for something. It's like, if I'm already convinced at this point, I'm just ruining moments for myself. That's how I consider it. But
why do you think this culture of spoiler phobia has, you know, kind of escalated the last, you know, 5 or 10 years? I feel like 10 years ago, I had not even heard of the word spoiler.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I wonder if it's if it has something to do with the way that movies are being marketed, and like maybe I don't know if I want to go as far as to say that movies that blockbusters are not as good now as they used to be, but there might be something to the way that movies are marketed now. They do tend to give away big set pieces, big moments that other, you know, previous trailers in previous generations might not have done. I mean, if you go all the way back, if you go back to, I don't know, film noir movies in the 40s, 50s, 60s, whatever, trailers would give away the whole movie pretty much. But then there was a period in between there and, I don't know, 1999 or something where, advertising did not give away every single plot beat. But now, I mean, we've seen this with previous Spider-Man movies, actually, where people have cut together every piece of marketing material and come up with, I don't know, what, you know, 10 or 15, 20 minutes of a movie that's been released before you get a chance to see it in the theater. So it's sort of, I think that has probably contributed to it, just the sheer amount of information that is out there and consumable for people. And then people, fandom is a passionate, it's a passionate group of people. And sometimes they want to, you know, dive in and talk about this stuff openly on social media. And I think the rise of social media has contributed to that as well. Sometimes you can't really opt out of conversations if you're not aware that they're happening until it's too late. So I don't know. I think it's a mixture of all of those things.
I think you're right on both accounts. I think Twitter and Facebook have, you know, also the fact that we're watching TV shows not at the same time. We're time shifting, and, you know, Netflix, and, you know, I've watched all of Glow and you haven't, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But so, and you mentioned Spider-Man. Sony is notoriously bad at giving away way too much, trying to oversell. Like, they're so unconfident, it seems, in their marketing that they're like, please see the movie. You know, Spider-Man Homecoming gives away nearly the entire movie. So I would suggest against watching those trailers. But I also wanted to mention that, you know, we care about trailers, or we care about spoilers on Slash Home. And we always try to keep anything that's a spoiler out of the headline, out of Above the Jump. And we try to give proper spoiler warning before we get to it. And I would hope, that's why, like, I responded to these people that were upset over the Spider-Man Homecoming Jennifer Connelly tweet headline, because I would hope that people that read us know that we care so much about protecting spoilers and protecting a movie that you know, that you trust us, that we have earned your trust. the other thing I wanted to talk about is, can spoilers actually ruin a movie? And you mentioned sitting in a movie waiting for those trailer moments to come up. Mm-hmm. But my argument would be, if it's a good story and a good movie, you aren't thinking about that. Do you know what I mean? If it's a good story and it's a good movie, you're into it and you're invested. And that kind of stuff comes up when you have the slow moments that aren't working.
I think my brain works weirdly, and I think there are a lot of people that I've spoken with that have the same thing, where it's like, yeah, even if I'm really into it, there's still this sort of nagging thing in the background. I can be like super into the story and completely sucked in, but there's still this thing that I can't shut off in my brain, where it's like I'm waiting on a couple of those moments to happen. And yeah, to some, you know, of course, in a bad movie where I'm just like my mind is wandering because the story is so terrible, then it's a lot more noticeable. But I think it's still there, this nagging thing that I can't quite shake.
Has a spoiler ever ruined a movie or TV show for you?
I
don't mean you being spoiled, but you feel like you're robbed of that experience. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I would say Split was a recent example. And I guess
let's not delve into what that is, but
right. I won't spoil Split, the ending of Split, but there is something that happens at the end of that movie that recontextualizes the everything that you've seen before. And if I went into that movie without knowing that, I would have watched it one way, and then I would have watched it way one, and then thought about it afterwards way two, right? Like having that new information presented. But in the way that I approached this movie, because I had it ruined for me beforehand, or spoiled, or whatever you want to call it, I watched the movie all the way through way two the first time, if that makes any sense.
That totally makes sense. I had a friend that had a similar experience with The Sixth Sense. He knew about the ending before going to see it the first time, and he watched it, but he didn't feel like he was robbed of it. He still had an enjoyable experience because I'm sure many people that have seen The Sixth Sense, which probably all of you out of there, I'm not going to spoil The Sixth Sense, but after seeing the movie once, if you see it again, you can rewatch it in a different context.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's still extremely enjoyable in that context.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is I you know, even with Split, I still enjoyed the movie. It wasn't ruined for me. So I think there are certain levels. Sixth Sense is always like the big go-to example, and that's one that I think the craft of filmmaking is so strong that even in that particular movie, that knowing the ending doesn't really hurt it that much. But it's just it's a matter of a spectrum of enjoyment, right? And like the 10 of that spectrum had been removed for me because I knew the ending beforehand. I still hit, you know, an 8 or whatever, like, a high, reasonable level of excitement and enjoyment of a movie. But it's that 10 that I'm always chasing as a moviegoer. So that's why I try to protect myself as much as I can in order to give myself the highest odds of experiencing that 10, as much as possible.
My view of things, I think, is completely different, and it's probably different than a lot of people out there. But my view is these big twists are almost gimmicks in their own way, and that if a story is great, it will play for you no matter if you know that gimmick or that twist is coming. And I'll give you two examples: Empire Strikes Back, and I will spoil this, but you know, Darth Vader is Luke Skywalker's father. And I think anybody of my age or younger, and I think that would include you, Ben.
Yes.
Who saw Empire Strikes Back probably knew that going into it, probably heard the Luke, I am your father. You know, it had been all over the place. Mm-hmm. But that movie is still one of my favorite movies, even though I knew that going into it. And every time that moment happens and Luke yells no, it still resonates in me. And even though I was quote unquote robbed of experiencing that moment in the movie, and would I have liked to have experienced that in the movie? Sure. But it's still one of my favorite movies. Even in every time I watch it, it's still great.
Yeah. The case can be made that it's all in the execution, right? That it doesn't matter as much if the execution is great. My thing is, it's very rare that the execution for me, that the execution is so good that it wipes away that extra little push that I would have gotten if I just saw it in context for the first time. Sometimes it does happen. Like I think Empire is a really good example where just the filmmaking and everything else about the movie around it works so well that it just is like, it becomes a non-factor. But, and yeah, for some movies where the twist or whatever is more of a gimmick. Yeah, I think you're right. I think there can be situations where that sort of detracts from the overall experience because of that. But I think, I don't know, I will say that I've gotten more lax about it over the years. I used to be like very militant about, you know, not seeing things at all.
Are you really like Jeff Cannata of Slash Filmcast fame? I've seen him at press screenings if they show trailers before it, and he'll have his fingers in his ear and his eyes closed, and he'll be like humming really loud.
Yeah. So
watching the trailers.
I used to do that. And now I've limited that to only things that I am like my most anticipated movies of the year. If I'm in a theater and there's a trailer and it's like not the teaser trailer, but you know, one of the second or third trailers or whatever that's come out. Yeah. And I have purposely avoided it at home, I will actually do that. But it really only happens, you know, two or three times a year now, whereas I used to do it all the time for like anything that I might be interested in. Now it's like I reserve those sort of publicly embarrassing moments for things where I hope that that it'll be worth it in the long run.
How does the wife handle that? Does the wife look over it?
You know, she understands where I'm coming from, thankfully. And she generally, she doesn't watch trailers unless I show one to her, because she knows that most of them are not great. But you know, we watched the most recent trailer for Game of Thrones, for example, and we were just like both blown away, even though we're both really looking forward to the new season. It was just like such an immaculately crafted thing that we had to appreciate it on that level, and then, you know, throw caution to the wind when it comes to ruining particular, you know, potentially iconic shots that might come up over the course of the next season. It was just like, man, we got to watch this. So I think there are shades to this whole thing, as with everything. You know, the answer probably lies somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I think most people are probably on your side on this one, but I would say try to consider that it's the journey, not the destination, that, you know, matters. We know in most of these movies that the good guy is going to win and the bad guy is going to lose. And that does not ruin that experience at all. It's how we get there and the storytelling that is involved in the process. Speaking of spoilers, today in the spoiler room, we have Jack Giroux to talk about the hidden movie references in Baby Driver. But before that, where can we find more of your work on the internet?
You can find me writing at slashfilm.com, and you can track me down on Twitter at twitter.com/BenPears.
So today in our spoiler discussion, I have with me Jack Giroux, who you know from slashfilm.com, and we are going to talk about some bits from Edgar Wright's Baby Driver. So if you have not seen the film, you might want to turn off the podcast right now. Return once you've seen the film. It's not like a huge spoiler, but it is, you know, further along in the film, and it is a reveal. So if you haven't seen the film, please turn away now. Okay, so what we're talking about is there's hidden movie references in Baby Driver that you may have not noticed their relevance. And it's interesting because I didn't notice. And in the film, it actually plays into the part of the plot of the film, and I didn't even notice that Baby basically uses the line from Monsters, Inc. on Kevin Spacey's character. And I didn't notice that until it was revealed by Kevin Spacey's character, because he found out from his nephew.
Yeah, and I think he uses lines from Fight Club, It's Complicated, and The Little Rascals, too.
Yes, and that's the basis of your thing. So tell us about that. Where does that come into play in this film?
Well, that I didn't notice until I saw Edgar Wright mention it in an interview. But once I started thinking about the connections between Monsters, Inc. and Baby Driver, like the whole idea of like a little kid in a world of monsters, and Mike Wachowski, that's the name, I believe, him doing the wrong job, clearly that's not his line of work. Like, it just felt relevant to Baby Driver. And then I started thinking about some of the other movies, and to me, it was just Edgar Wright would not pick those movies randomly. Like, he probably picked them with purpose.
Edgar Wright is known to throw hidden Easter eggs that you can find by exploring his films, you know, multiple times. You know, obviously in Scott Pilgrim's, there's all those X's that are all over the place. In Shaun of the Dead, there's that conversation between him and Ed that I think basically predicts the entire plot of the film. Edgar Wright is you know, that's what he does, is he likes hiding references that make his films rewatchable. So what do these films that were on Baby's TV have to do with the plot of Baby Driver?
Well, it's complicated hiding an affair, which Baby does. I look at the crime family as his family. Like, when they're together, the way they interact, the way John Hamm's character sticks up with him, almost like an uncle. And so he's hiding this relationship from them, just like it's complicated. They're hiding their relationship from everyone else. Little Rascals, I don't recall so vividly, but I just remember racing, obviously, being a huge part of that movie. And that's also...
Yeah, they raced in, like, these boxcar things.
Yeah, I think that's the whole ending. And obviously, little kid in love, so there's that. And what else is there? Fight Club, the idea of the narrator always trying to keep Marla out of his life or what he's doing in Project Mayhem, and then at the end she gets pulled into it. And then what was the other?
Monsters, Inc., which is pretty obvious and you've already stated. And I'm sure there's many other references in that movie that we have not noticed, but those...
I know Walter Hill has a voice cameo in it. I forget where.
It's at the end, in the court. He is like the court announcer or court something. I saw it in the credits and I was like, whoa. Anyways, just interesting. If you notice any other fun Easter eggs in Edgar Wright's Baby Driver, please send it to us at peter@slashfilm.com. And, oh, you have one more thing?
Yeah, I was going to say, I just love stuff like that because it just makes the movie feel so much fuller. And to make a movie about a getaway driver that has, you know, references to Monsters, Inc. or It's Complicated, that can have you thinking about it a few days later, to me, I mean, that's just cool.
And even for the more obvious one, the one that Kevin Spacey brings up later in the film, I didn't think that callback was going to come back. It's interesting because it's used as, like, he's trying to change the channel away from a story on the news about one of his heists, right? Trying to keep his uncle?
His stepdad.
Away from seeing that news. And I just discounted it as pure just, like, oh, fun movie references. But no, there's something deeper to it all.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, just the way that joke's set up and paid off. I mean, it's a plot point in the movie Monsters, Inc. when he says that to him by the elevator. It's like, that moves the story along. Like, I just think that's so creative, and yeah, I guess that's all I gotta say.
Jack, where can we find more of your work on the internet?
Slash Film Monday through Friday.
Thanks for listening to today's edition of Slash Film Daily. I apologize that it is so long. We intended this to be a much shorter episode, but in the future we will try to keep these under 30 minutes. You can find more news at slashfilm.com. You can subscribe to Slash Film Daily on iTunes, Google Play, Overcast, or all the popular podcast apps. The podcast is published every weekday, bringing you the most interesting news from the world of movies and television and deeper dives into our great features from slashfilm.com. We're still very much experimenting with this podcast, so feel free to send your feedback to peter@slashfilm.com, and you can also submit your entries for inclusion in the mailbag at peter@slashfilm.com. Please leave your name and your general geographic location just in case we use your question on Slash Film Daily. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.